We're on page 104 in the Kuzari, which is the first essay, paragraph large number 90. And after the rabbi has attempted to explain the apparent paradox of how a completely transcendent and non-physical God can interact within a physical world with physical beings, the Kuzari says, this suffices to explain your belief in a non-physical God who works within the physical universe. Okay, you gave me some level of satisfaction. You explained to me that God does not require tools or intermediaries, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu undeniably appeared and manifested himself at Sinai because of the eyewitness testimony of millions of people. And the last part that the rabbi has to say is sort of almost like a postscript. It's almost like an apology, because he's going to explain that even though you may be satisfied with this response, I'm not totally satisfied with it, because I don't claim to understand how this paradox can be reconciled logically. And so take a look at the bottom on paragraph 91, and we just would like to ask someone to volunteer to read today. Who can we get? Okay, loud city.
The rabbi said, I am not claiming this is exactly the way God interacts with the physical. Perhaps there is something deeper involved that is beyond our grasp. But in any event, we may conclude that all who were present at these wondrous happenings believe that what they were witnessing came directly from God, without any intermediary. These events displayed the same faculties that God used when he created the universe, creation and formation. Consequently, those present believed in the Torah that was given with these miracles. Moreover, by seeing God as creator through his creation of things like the tablets of the law and the manna, they also confirm that God created the universe anew. It is therefore through these miracles that all the arguments of the philosophers and all others who believe in an eternal universe are discredited.
Okay, so the first thing that he says is an apology. I'm not claiming that this is exactly the way that God interacts with the physical. It really is, to a large degree, a mystery, and it's going to remain a mystery, because logically, it doesn't really make sense how a completely transcendent being can interact. But at the end of he says, perhaps there's something deeper that's beyond our grasp. Perhaps there just are certain things that the human being was never meant to fully comprehend. But one thing we do know is that the people that were there, they clearly understood and apprehended a God that was right in front of them without any intermediaries. Now, the last thing that he says on this topic is that the purpose of God performing these miracles when he took the Jewish people out of Egypt was to replicate the same kind of godliness, the same kind of God of creation that God employed, this type of power that he has, that he employed when he created the universe. So why did he do that? Why did God employ the same powers that he used when creating the universe? He employed those very same powers to bring about all of these supernatural phenomena, these miracles. And of course, what is the commonality between those two? Creation is the epitome of a transcendent God interacting with the physical universe, because creation is the ultimate interaction between the divine and the physical. Creation is where God, before there was creation, there was only God. And God spawns off of himself a physical reality. And so perhaps what Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is alluding to is the fact that the very fact that creation itself is a mystery. How is it that physicality can be spawned from a God who is completely non-physical? How can such a thing come to be? It's one of the great mysteries that all philosophers pondered, all philosophers who believed in a creation depiction. The great Jewish philosopher, who was not particularly devout as far as being faithful to the Torah, but nevertheless was known as one of the first great Jewish philosophers. Philo was one who pondered this question greatly. And he came to the conclusion that there must be a series of intermediary actions that God did in order to create, in order to bring about this physical universe that we have today. Plotinus, who is a descendant philosophically of Philo, and his disciples, which formed the school of Neoplatonism, discussed this question extensively about how it is that a completely transcendent, non-physical God can interact with the physical universe to act as the creator and to act as the functionary of the orchestration of everything that exists. So these are the big questions. And these are the questions that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi says, despite all of the problems with trying to reconcile it, God manifested this kind of connection between himself and the physical world at the time of Yetzias Mitzrayim and at the time of Matan Torah. So why is that? Because, very simply, no one was around at the time of creation. No one was there to bear witness to this kind of connection between God and the physical universe. The Jewish people bear testimony to this kind of mysterious interaction between the ultimately transcendent and the completely mundane. That's what the function of all of the miracles that happened at the time of the Exodus, at the time of redemption. That, for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi and for a lot of the great Jewish philosophers, is the primary function of these miracles. You know, it's interesting that there are a lot of different interpretations to this question. For the Ramban, the reason why God performed so many miracles at the time of Yetzias Mitzrayim was to enable us to appreciate that every moment in our lives is a miracle. And that's a beautiful message. The Ramban says at the end of Parshas Bo that by contemplating all of the miracles that Hashem performed at the time of the plagues, Kriyas Yamsuf, etc., etc., it enables us to really realize that there is nothing more miraculous about the splitting of the Red Sea than there is about the sun rising every day, or that our hearts are beating inside of us on a constant basis so that our lungs are constantly filling with air automatically without our even being aware of it. That, for the Ramban, is a very important message. For Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, the message is to explain this very idea that we are dealing with a creator, that we are dealing with a God who is very much an interactive God and is part of this world. That's the purpose of the miracles, to remind us of the creation. And it fits in very well with the whole theme of what we say at Kiddush, both on Shabbos and on Yom Tov, as we've mentioned before. Both on Shabbos and Yom Tov, we say the very same phrases. We say that both Shabbos and Yom Tov are Zecher L'maasei Bereishis and Zecher L'Yetzias Mitzrayim, that they remind us of the act of creation, and they remind us of the Exodus. So I understand how Shabbos reminds us of Bereishis, and I understand how Yom Tov reminds us of Yetzias Mitzrayim. But how does Yom Tov remind us of Maaseh Bereishis, and how does Shabbos remind us of Yetzias Mitzrayim? And of course, you see from this paragraph that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi has answered that question. He's told us that the two are directly interrelated. That once we experienced the events at Yetzias Mitzrayim in Har Sinai, this affirmed to humanity on an experiential level that God created, because no one was there at the time of creation to bear witness. We bore witness at the time of Yetzias Mitzrayim that our God is the God of creation. And that is a way to dispel the great challenge of the Aristotelians who believe in the eternity of the universe, that there really is no God who's directly interactive with our world, that our world has eternally existed, it's never been created. Why did Aristotle say that the world has eternally existed? Because he couldn't fathom this great mystery and he couldn't reconcile the great mystery that is asserted by the Torah, that the transcendent can connect with the physical. That's what he couldn't reconcile. And Rabbi Yehuda Halevi acknowledges that it's a mystery. He acknowledges that it's a dilemma and that we won't be able to answer it. And that by logic, Aristotle makes a lot of sense. But you cannot deny our own experience. You cannot deny the fact that we were there. And the fact that we were there means that no matter what kind of logical arguments you're going to make to suggest that it's impossible, it happened. Okay? And by the way, this is thematically the going to be driven across to us by Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi time after time after time. We've seen it already. Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi has said, you cannot deny your eyes. You cannot deny your senses. You cannot deny your experiences. There are a lot of things that don't make sense about God, and there are a lot of things that don't make sense about this religion, that and the faith affirmations of our religion. But you know what? Your mind only takes you so far. Logic only takes you so far. There are things that just don't make sense in life, and yet they still are real. There are paradoxes all around us in life. You know, the people that we love the most are the people that we hate the most. That's a paradox, right? Isn't that a paradox of reality? And there's so many other paradoxes of life. And so we live with paradoxes all the time. And this is one of the paradoxes that we live with because it's a reality that we cannot deny, despite its illogic. You don't agree with that? The people that we love the most, the people that we hate the most?
Okay. More than I want to admit.
Okay, maybe that's not such a great example. Pick your own example. Okay. Now, we're just going to start on the next topic today. So, Tzippi, please read paragraph 92.
The Kuzari said, "Be careful, Rabbi, that you do not overstate the praise of your people and overlook the well-known account of their rebellion during this period of miracles. For I have heard that in the midst of all this, they made a golden calf and worshipped it instead of God."
Now, this seems to be coming out of left field. This seems to be totally unrelated to our previous discussion. It's important for us to realize that medieval writers did not codify things in the way that you would find, let's say, in the Shulchan Aruch, or that you would find in the writings of the Rambam in his Mishneh Torah, to say, you know, okay, chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3, and that there's a sequential connectivity to them all. Not always is that the case, because you can jump from one topic to another and just change gears. So, simple understanding is that perhaps this Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi had exhausted his topic and is ready to switch gears and talk about something else. Let's talk about the golden calf. You claim that the Jewish people are the chosen people. Well, what about the golden calf? How could they be so special if they worshiped a god right after receiving the Torah? They worshiped the false god. They made themselves a molten image, a graven image, and how could it be that you say that they're so great after they worshiped a golden calf? But of course, I don't think that a wise man would speak in that way and just create two totally different topics and connect them without any connection whatsoever. So we have to conclude that, and this is consistent throughout the Kuzari, that there are connections between the topics, even when Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi switches gears. So I want you to think for yourselves for just a moment. What is, we're about to engage in a discussion about the story of the golden calf. Now, Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is not a Bible commentary. The Kuzari is not meant as a biblical commentary. So we're going to spend a number of pages describing the story of the Egel HaZahav, of the golden calf. We're going to try and make sense of it from Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi's perspective of what actually the sin was, what actually the Jewish people were thinking when they made a golden calf. And we have to ask ourselves two questions. Question number one, how does this discussion relate to what we were just immediately talking about up until now, over the last couple of weeks? And question number two, why is this in the book of the Kuzari in the first place, if this is really a book about explaining Judaism and not about explaining specific events and stories and biblical passages? You got the two questions? What is this doing here? Ideas. Yes, Mary.
The funny thing is, I was going to ask you this question, and it's only because we are, you know, coming from a point where we're leaving Egypt, he in darkness weeded out those who were undeserving, and then they went through these miracles, and you would think that they would be so filled with awe that they would want to do exactly what they're told to do, and yet right in the face of more and more miracles, they go and do this.
They go and do this, yeah. That's exactly right. So, at face value, what?
It pokes holes
at what? What does it poke holes at?
In the belief that they're so deserving and so special and that they all witnessed it.
Okay, good. So it pokes holes at the deservedness of the Jewish people. It pokes holes at the fact that the Jewish people were actually witness to God, because if after all, this is what they could do, maybe they really didn't witness God. Good. What else?
I think also might show that the human beings have trouble with the transcendent and what they can't see and feel, and that they do fall for the physical world.
Well, you're answering the question. The question is, how could they worship the golden calf? And so, Vivian, you're answering, and you're saying this is how they could do it. Okay, we're going to get there. We're going to see what Rabbi Yehuda Leib's perspective on that is. But the first question that we want to address is, why ask the question in the first place? So I think Miriam got us started off, and what you're saying is what we're going to see in just a moment from Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. And there's one other thing that we have to just point out. First of all, the fact that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is actually returning to his discussion of chosenness. Now remember, one of the central themes of the Kuzari is that the Jewish people are the fifth level of creation. That there's human beings, and human beings are special, because they're higher than animals, and animals are higher than organic life, and organic life is higher than non-organic things that exist in this world. But that there's a fifth plane of existence, and what is that? The superhuman. And who is the superhuman? Super Jew, right? Superman. The Superman is the Jew who's capable of the prophetic experience, and who's capable of revelation. And that, I hope you didn't forget that, because that was actually a discussion before we started talking about revelation at Sinai. If we go back, you'll have to go back a few pages. It's all the way back on page 74, back paragraph 41, 42, 43, 44, 45. Okay, all of those paragraphs start talking about the chosen status of the Jewish people, that we occupy this special level. So Rabbi Yehuda Levi's got to go back to that. And he said, well, we haven't, one second. The Jewish people are so special. One second, you're not so special. How could such a special people fall so quickly and so far by worshiping a golden calf after Revelation? And maybe Revelation, as Miriam said, didn't take place. And furthermore, now this is what we're getting to now, Vivian's point, which is part of the mystery of the synthesis between the transcendent and the mundane, this idea of God meeting the transcendent, God meeting the physical world, doesn't that in itself give rise to a form of idolatry? Doesn't that itself engender idolatry? Remember, what Rabbi Yehuda Halevi has done is that he's done that which the Rambam was not prepared to do. Remember in our creating this dichotomy between Maimonides and Rabbi Yehuda Halevi? The Rambam explains that the events at Sinai were not as physical as we think that they might be. We really didn't hear an objective ontological voice of God. This was a voice that was only in our minds, and it wasn't the words themselves, it was just the sound that every Jew heard from a prophecy that went straight into our heads. But there was no physical voice of God for the Rambam, because how can God be part of the physical plane? Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's emphasis is just precisely the opposite, that there was a physical manifestation of God in our world. His voice was audible, and if you had that MP3 recorder, you'd be able to capture God's voice, and you'd be able to play it back, because it was a real physical voice that was made by vibrations of the wind. And if that's the case, then Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is bolstering the answer to the question before he's even answered the question. Understand that God is the creator of the tablets, which is something physical that he gives to the Jewish people. Why did God need to give the Jewish people tablets in the first place? Why did he need to insert himself in the physical plane to engrave those tablets in the first place? Why does there have to be an ark that the Jewish people all surround and celebrate and make the focus of their religious expression that travels with them in the desert?
We need
that. So that's already the precursor to his discussion of the golden calf. And this is all leading up to the delicate balance that a Jew has to create in his mind between the transcendent God and the immanent God. The God that transcends all physicality and the God that inserts himself into our physical world. And the golden calf is an overcompensation, of course, because of the fact that God so readily inserted himself into our physical world because he knew that we needed it. And this is what happens as a result. It's all about balance. And so that's just our introduction. That would be just to explain, why are we talking about the golden calf here? And now we're going to get into that, and we'll talk about that next week. Okay, we'll hold it here.